Welcome Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. On today's show, we'll hear the story of the Appalachian and Atlas Mountains. What does a night sky in West Virginia have in common with a starry sky in Morocco? And what connects us with our sister mountains across the globe?
But the stars were just, there were so many. There was so, the skies were so clear, the air was so clear, you could see. It felt like you could just stir them up with your hands.
And why one woman was reminded of her family's home place in the mountains of Morocco when she moved to West Virginia.
I felt home. I think it's the link that I have with my roots. That's something that I'm very, very proud of.
And although natural resources like water are plentiful here in our mountains, crumbling infrastructure and years of coal mining have led to many issues with our drinking water. We'll hear updates from our ongoing coverage about water in the coal fields.
Water means everything. It's a matter of managing what we've got and what we can expect. And there are things that are out of control, but there are things that, you know, we can mediate.
You'll find these stories and more this week inside Appalachia. Welcome inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly. I grew up in southern West Virginia, and if you too grew up in Appalachia, maybe you're like me and you didn't even realize just how much the mountains shaped some of your earliest memories. Think back to the first time you left the mountains. I personally couldn't wait to get out of Appalachia and travel to the city. I was a teenager when I went to New York City. I was so excited. But when I returned, it was as if I had never realized before just how different our landscape looks compared to the rest of the country. As I've gotten older, I've realized just how much of my identity and maybe even my mindset is what it is because of where I grew up. Today, we're listening back to a show from last year in which we explore some ways the land around us shapes us and how we interact with our surroundings. We start with the mountains that gave Appalachia its name. Here at West Virginia Public Broadcasting, we have an occasional series called Wild Wandering West Virginia. We heard one of these stories last week exploring whether West Virginia could be self-sustaining. If you missed that story, you can listen back on our podcast. All of our stories and episodes are archived at wvpublic.org. Today, we're going to hear another wild wandering story, which was inspired by Brian Joseph of Wheeling, West Virginia. He wanted to know about the Appalachian Mountains and their sister mountains and how they shape who we are.
And sometimes we forget, we think we are who we are, but remember even our state motto, Montani Semper Libri, which is mountaineers will always be free.
While at one time researchers considered the Appalachian Mountains among the oldest on Earth, West Virginia Public Broadcasting's Glynis Board found they might also be the youngest.
Our story starts on a steep slope in the northern panhandle of West Virginia.
And now what we're walking up to, just came into view, is our apple orchard here on Wheeling Housing Authority-owned land. But, you know, in the context of what we've been talking about, calling it owned land is almost silly.
This is Danny Swan, Executive Director of Grow Ohio Valley, a nonprofit that wants to improve communities around here through local food. He wanted to grow blueberries on this hillside, but can't because of what happened here several hundred million years ago.
250 to 300 million years ago, we were underwater. This was the Permian period, underwater in a shallow ocean with an ecosystem that looked a lot like modern-day coral reefs. What are coral reefs primarily composed of? Calcium.
Turns out blueberries are not into growing in calcium-rich soil for reasons we should have learned about in high school.
So here we are standing on top of a mountain in the Rust Belt Appalachian city of Wheeling, West Virginia, working against agricultural problems that are the result of a ecological system that was happening 250 to 300 million years ago.
The young apple trees here, though, appear to be thriving. Danny and his team of farmers are making it work. But in order to do that well, he did find himself literally and figuratively dipping into the story of the Appalachian Mountains. It's a story that shapes what he's doing, what he's eating, what he's feeding his community, and, well, we are what we eat. To think about the lifespan of a mountain range is to impose a human sense of time on geology. Humans can live 100 years. Mountains typically live 100 million years. Oh, and by the way, the Appalachian region is more than a billion years old. Now, while it's commonly thought that the Appalachian chain is one of the oldest on the planet, the reality is very complicated.
How do you date mountains? We don't have a way of dating topography.
That's West Virginia University geology professor Steve Kite. He explains the rocks in the Appalachians are not actually the oldest in the world. But boy, do they tell us a long and detailed story about the region. The truth is, several mountain chains have been born here, grew, and died away completely.
And there are a couple of mountain-building episodes, and those mountains formed, and then they wore down. Things were kind of quiet. And those mountains formed even later at about 450 million years ago, and those wore down, and things were kind of quiet. And then about 360 million years ago, another mountain-building episode, and those mountains wore away, and things were kind of quiet. And then the big Alleghenian mountain-building episode.
He's talking there about Pangaea, the most recent supercontinent. The range that was born then predates dinosaurs by at least 100 million years, by the way. And those mountains have long since eroded away, gone 150 million years ago. So here's the plot twist. Geologists don't quite know how to explain how the Appalachian Mountains that exist here today exist at all.
The Appalachian Mountains have popped back up. The topography that we see today really dates back to the last 20 million years or so.
Kite says scientists have only recently discovered and begun to build theories explaining this geologic mystery.
It may be indirectly related to the mountain building episodes that are going on the West Coast, the Laramide mountain building event that gives us the Rocky Mountains. You can think about if there's a train wreck on the far side of the mountain, there's likely to be stresses transmitted, pretty far.
There are other theories as well, but the long and the short of it is the mountains seem to be growing again. You could argue that the Appalachians are one of the oldest and maybe one of the youngest mountain ranges in the world. So, ours is very much a story of rebirth. The mountain remnants that give us historical clues today also exist in northern Europe, Scotland, and in northern Africa, the Atlas Mountains. I mentioned to my dad recently that I wished I could visit the Atlas Mountains. He's a pilot and a storyteller, and he's lived many lives. So I wasn't totally surprised when he mentioned that he's actually already been. So what was it like? What was it like in the mountains?
People were very poor, but very hospitable. I spent a lot of time in someone's house while they were beading out copper pans, putting all kinds of designs on them, and with moon-shaped things and star-shaped things, and, just all these things would be taken into the local souk market set to be sold to tourists, and milking goats and just living a very simple life with some very simple, honest people.
Talk to me about the stars.
Well, the stars, I thought the stars in the desert, in the Moroccan desert, were incredible. But they were nothing like the stars when you got up about 14,000 feet above sea level. Perfectly dry air, freezing cold, but the stars were just... There were so many, the skies were so clear, the air was so clear, you could see, it felt like you could just stir them up with your hands.
My dad said the Atlas Mountains didn't look anything like Appalachia. But it's worth noting that people do come from all over to stargaze here as the darkest place on the East Coast is nestled within the Appalachian Mountains. Researchers think people first inhabited both the Appalachians and the Atlas Mountains around the same time, roughly 14,000 years ago. But time and latitudes have shaped the ranges very differently. It would be great to be able to explore the Atlas Mountains like my father did, to speak with people in mountain communities and see how they live and what they value. Here in West Virginia, for example, we say Montani Sempre Libre, mountaineers are always free. So I was intrigued to find that in the Atlas Mountains, they call themselves Amaziran, which translates to free people. I learned this from an Amaziri woman named Ikram Benaisha, who lived for a spell in Charleston, West Virginia.
The Atlas Mountains are wild and beautiful.
Ikram grew up visiting her grandparents in a town surrounded by the Atlas Mountains. It's where her dad grew up.
I have a lot of memories as a kid. We used to go once a year, and on our way to where my dad is from, we used to listen to those like beautiful songs in Shilha or Amazigh language. And it happens to me that every time like I wanna travel in time and space, I would just like play one of those songs and it just makes my day. The geography have shaped not only my grandparents, but my dad. It shaped me as well. Back in the days, it was very hard to live in the mountains. They used to lack access to improved sanitation and to safe water. My dad have taught me to be determined. He used to tell me stories from his childhood, how tough it was and how committed he had to be. My dad is my hero. He is the purest version of an ambitious Amaziri from the Atlas Mountains.
I'd heard that people native to the mountains were called Berber. Ikram had to explain to me that the term is offensive because it connotes being backward or uncivilized, which made me think of the terms redneck and hillbilly. She says it misrepresents the Amaziran, the free people. I can relate.
The Atlas Mountains are the perfect place to seek calmness and joy. The Amaziq communities are very welcoming and very generous. And honestly, I have noticed a lot of similarities once I was in West Virginia.
Ikram came to West Virginia in 2015 to get a master's degree at West Virginia State University.
To be honest with you, once I have arrived to Charleston, I felt home. I think it's the link that I have with my roots. That's something that I'm very, very proud of.
Ikram also mentioned that she used to listen to country music when she was back home in Morocco. She says artists like Reba McEntire struck a chord with her. I was born a stubborn soul, ain't afraid of the great unknown, or a winding road that's all uphill. This is just a stumbling block, intimidating while a rock. If you think this broken heart will break my will. Just as it can be difficult to grasp geologic time, it can be equally challenging to clearly identify the ways that geography shapes us culturally. But in the same breath, nothing can be more influential. Steve Kite, the geologist from WVU, explains that the Appalachians, for example, well, they make it hard to get around, and that may fundamentally shape culture.
The topography of the Appalachians, you know, it's steep. We might be steeper than Colorado, not higher, but steeper.
The steep slopes make it harder to get around. And that inconvenience has carved out some smaller, more isolated communities.
I think one of the characteristics of Appalachians in general, and I call myself a native Appalachian, although I'm from Virginia, it's the westernmost part. I think that isolation of communities winds up making us more locally based and locally focused on our concerns than you would find in a Kansas or a landscape that was flatter and easier to move around in.
Perhaps poets and musicians are best left to illustrate the indescribable deep and ancient mountain roots that connect us to the ground that holds us generation to generation, shaping the farmers, scientists, travelers, and storytellers that we become. Just reflections of the mountains that are born, grow, die away, and are reborn. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Glynis Board, reporting from some of the oldest and maybe newest mountains in the world.
Wow, listening to that story, I just got goosebumps. And thinking about the connections we have with people who live in our sister mountain range in Morocco, and how our rugged geography may actually be what gave root to our independent spirit. Lord knows my daughter carries this spirit. One of her favorite lines as a kid was, "I'd do it myself." Not everyone can identify as fiercely independent, though. I mean, I guess it could be seen as closed-minded or unwelcoming. While working on the show, I've learned that the term Appalachian hasn't always been used as a compliment. Yep, all this time I thought it was just us West Virginians who had a reputation for not owning shoes or brushing our teeth. Nope, come to find out, people in parts of Kentucky, Ohio, and other states, well, y'all have dealt with this stereotype too. Apparently, it's all of us Appalachians. All right, I have a kind of confession to make. Until a few years ago, I didn't realize I was Appalachian. I know. Don't tell anybody, okay? Growing up in West Virginia, I learned about the Appalachian Mountains, but I'd never thought of it as an identity, never even heard anyone use the word Appalachian, and never heard of the Appalachian Regional Commission, also known as the ARC, which was created after a number of studies showed the region was struggling with poverty. President Lyndon Johnson signed the law creating the new federal agency in March of 1965. The program's establishment focused the government's attention on the area and created a regional identity. Anyway, I never really felt like a part of this group. Frankly, as a West Virginian, it was tough to find common ground with people in some of the surrounding states. The author of a new book came to a similar point of personal self-discovery. Appalachian North by Matthew Ference is a memoir about the realization he had as an adult that he, too, is Appalachian, even though growing up in Pennsylvania, he never heard people talk about this identity. Inside Appalachia associate producer Eric Douglas sat down with Ference to talk about what it means to be Appalachian, even if you're from above the Mason-Dixon line.
Matthew Ference describes Appalachian North as a geological, cultural, and a personal journey. It's a memoir. In the book, he talks about how it wasn't until he was a graduate student at West Virginia University that he realized he was Appalachian. His book explores why his family and friends never identified with the region. Ference also describes his diagnosis with a brain tumor, which becomes an analogy for the exploration into his roots.
That was the first inkling for that part of the book, is what does it mean to be from north of the Mason-Dixon line, but still fully Appalachian? And then the other part of it was the medical trauma recovery narrative, which was my diagnosis with a brain tumor and surgery and radiation. And in thinking about this book, so I was actually trying to write the former book after I'd recovered and not thinking about writing a memoir about my brain. But that kept wanting to be told as a story. And I realized that figuratively thinking about erosion and geology and the rocks that make us in a figurative sense work together really well, because both understanding myself as an Appalachian and understanding myself after significant medical setback cause you to rethink who you are.
What surprised you when you were writing the book?
One was geological, and it was in talking to my father, who studied geology for a long time. He was a conservation biologist by career. And I was asking him about the ancient Appalachian Mountains and how they wore down to become what we live in now. And he said, well, we don't live in the mountains. We live in the old Allegheny Plateau. And so all of our relief in the region is erosion downward from a high plateau instead of a big old mountain that had been worn down through time. And for me, that was a surprise. I hadn't realized that. And I hadn't realized that really a great bulk of Appalachia is in that plateau. And that opened up metaphors for me to completely recalibrate that we're not actually climbing mountains, we're coming out of valleys. And there's a beauty to that.
I thought that was interesting too, talking about the ARC, and that, I mean, to a large degree, the ARC controls everything about Appalachia now. And that was a document created 50 something years ago, and with and even a completely different mindset in the country at the time. Right. So,
And I think what's fascinating in looking through some of those original documents and also the reports that come out periodically is the tropes continue that, essentially talk about, you know, the barefoot, dirty, poverty-stricken child and how this program is helping to improve that. And also the original documents are pretty clear that the way forward, and this actually even predates the ARC documents, that the way forward is the exploitation of the natural resources. So the stories themselves control what we can ever imagine ourselves to be. And the ARC is a wonderful thing, and I think a tremendous success in so many ways. But if we don't interrogate the narrative behind it, then we're kind of at risk of always being victimized.
It strikes me as the classic hero's journey. You know, you've had your inciting incident, and then you were off on your path of self-discovery. Do we get to, at the end of it, do we get to the point where you've had a redemptive moment and completed the hero's journey?
I would say yes and no to that. I mean, I think that's a good way of thinking about the structure of the book or the structure of the reflection I'm working through. For me, that climax of the journey or the destination is mostly a recognition that there isn't a destination, and that and I teach this a lot when I'm talking to students, particularly about memoir, but that we live our lives with this expectation of that hero's journey or the Freytag pyramid of arc. And what we actually often recognize is that life itself doesn't have that kind of pathway.
What do you hope your readers take away from the book?
One thing is for readers who are north of the Mason-Dixon line, who are like me, who grew up Appalachian and not knowing it, I want them to recognize and embrace the culture that they are, so that they can be part of that. And then for fellow Appalachians south of the Mason-Dixon line, I hope that it complicates their notions of the region as well. But then my hopeful readership, I suppose, is for those outside of Appalachia who think they know what we are, to just add another inconvenient piece to the puzzle that doesn't allow us to think the way we always did.
That was Matthew Ferentz, author of his memoir, Appalachia North, talking with Eric Douglas. Up ahead, why butterflies may be drawn to fly along Ohio's highways, and we'll visit a West Virginia landfill that turns trash into fuel. You're Inside Appalachia. I'm Jessica Lilly.
Support for Inside Appalachia is provided by Concord University in Athens, West Virginia. With career-focused liberal arts education in more than 80 degrees and programs to pursue various career options, not just a single job. More at concord.edu.
On today's show, we're talking about identity and how our surroundings shape us. Across the country, highways and interstates cut through much of our natural landscape. More than 160,000 miles worth of pavement, most often bordered by grass that has to be mowed. But some communities want to change that. In Ohio, for example, the State Highway Department started planting wildflowers that are good pollinators for monarch butterflies. But this approach isn't only beneficial for the butterflies. To learn more, last summer, WOSU's Steve Brown met up with the person in charge of the project at the Ohio Department of Transportation, also referred to as ODOT, in this next piece.
You might not think of the banks of Interstate 71 as a nature preserve, but that's basically what state officials are going for in a project to line freeways with wildflowers. Beautifying otherwise bland interstates is just one of the reasons behind it. Joining me now at one of these wildflower sites near Moffray Stadium in Columbus is Joel Hunt. He oversees the effort for the Ohio Department of Transportation. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Steve.
Lots of reasons for doing this. First of all, most appealing to drivers probably, it beautifies these otherwise kind of ugly roadways. And secondly, it gives wildlife a habitat. It helps pollinators, right?
Yeah, that's right. So in Ohio, ODOT manages 19,000 miles of roadsides. And in the past, we've typically mowed 4 to 10 times per year. Last year, we started pulling back our mowers to encourage the growth of milkweed and other wildflowers to benefit pollinators. And really, this program is a trifecta because it benefits wildlife, it reduces costs for ODOT, saving taxpayers money, and it also benefits wildlife and pollinators especially.
Right, and pollinators are very important to our food supply. In regard to how much money this is saving, how much is it saving?
Last year it saved $2.2 million, and this year we expect that number to go significantly higher because we really got this program going in the middle of last year, and we've been planting steadily over the winter and all this spring.
And this saves money by basically on payroll, less diesel fuel for mowers and things. We're standing at this wildflower site just off Interstate 71. This is one of the newer ones, right?
Yeah, this is one of the newer of our 120 sites we have around the state. And this one's unique because it's our first urban pollinator habitat. And this is a partnership with the Friends of the Lower Olentangy Watershed. They've essentially provided the labor and equipment and materials for planting this site, and they've agreed to manage it for 4 years. So by partnering with groups like FLO, we're able to accomplish more and save taxpayers money at the same time.
This seems like a wonderful program. I guess my only cynical question was, why didn't we do this 20, 30 years ago?
The monarch butterfly is really what's driving the bus here because it was petitioned to be listed as an endangered species back in 2014. And so knowing that it was going to directly impact the work we do on roadsides, we began establishing these pollinator habitats around the state. But what's good habitat for monarch butterflies is good habitat for bees and birds and bats and all the other pollinators that we have.
This is a newer site. Is it fair to say you plan to add more?
Yes, yeah. We've been really busy planting 800 acres this spring, and we plan to add 125 acres each year going forward.
Could there be a day when all Ohio freeways are lined by wildflowers instead of just grass?
They already are. When we pulled our mowers back last year from the ditch to the right-of-way fence, motorists, I'm sure, have seen over the past year more wildflowers start to emerge.
So by pulled back, you mean completely removed?
Last summer, we pulled back our mowers, meaning that instead of mowing from the edge of the pavement to the fence, up to 4, maybe even up to 10 times per year, we're only doing one mowing per year, and that's in the fall. So all those wildflowers that have been in the seed bank that we've mowed off are starting to emerge. And just last year, by reducing our mowing, we created 80,000 acres of suitable habitat for pollinators.
Joel Hunt is with the Ohio Department of Transportation. We've been talking about a program to plant wildflowers on the side of Ohio freeways. It beautifies the roadways, helps pollinators, and saves money on mowing. Joel Hunt, thanks again.
Thank you, Steve.
That was WOSU's Steve Brown reporting from Ohio back in the summer of 2019. Understanding our environment and surroundings can get complicated quickly. We're talking about science, but a professor has taken a unique approach to help students understand biology. An associate professor of biology at West Liberty University in West Virginia is cracking the code to help his students understand tricky topics. Corey Nollinger has more.
You're walking through the halls of West Liberty University's main hall, and instead of hearing your usual lecture, you hear this. You think, this is kind of interesting, and you pop your head in.
Psalms just had to double before I went through all the trouble.
That's Joe Horzempa, an associate professor of biology at West Liberty University, and he has what can be described as an unorthodox way of teaching science. In the lab, Horzempa and his students study vaccines, which is a pretty demanding task, as Horzempa points out.
There's a lot of failure in the laboratory, a lot of experiments that, you know, you would call a failure, but you learn something from every experiment. You develop a construct, you work years on it, and it either doesn't produce the protein correctly, you don't get the antibody response that you thought you were going to get.
But in the classroom, you don't have years to experiment with students to see what will get a response. While you may see some students over again in their time in college, a professor generally only has one shot at getting information across. That's why Horzempa turned to an old pastime to make themselves laugh, to help students learn.
I thought, man, wouldn't it be cool to take my love of music and incorporate it in the classroom somehow? When my friends and I were young, we used to always kind of, you know, a la Weird Al Yankovic, make song parodies. So we'd hear a song and we'd change the words and make each other laugh. And so that's what I do in the classroom.
Some of Horzempa's hits include American Pitosis.
So bye-bye envelope of the nuclei. Centrioles will form the asters and moon.
Cell Division in the style of Don McLean's American Pie. A song about bacterial byproducts in the style of Piano Man, among others.
I am thick and gram-positive bacteria.
But he's always wary of the effectiveness of the songs themselves.
I don't know. I don't know if it helps them learn the material better. Maybe it does. Maybe the song gets in their head. But I tell you, it makes them want to come to class more, and it makes them enjoy it more. It makes them talk about science a little bit more.
But there's an added benefit that Horzempa may be overlooking, as junior chemistry student Mackenzie Jacobs points out.
Whenever he plays the guitar and sings the songs, it inspires me to be more creative about the topic. It really gets my wheels and my mind spinning, like, oh wow, there are so many cool things you can do with the knowledge that you know.
Horzempa was recognized as the state's Professor of the Year in 2017, but he says it's not awards, but student opportunities that keep him going.
Whenever a student comes to me and says, I've made it into medical school, I got into this grad program, I got a job working for this laboratory. That's the stuff that really makes me sort of feel like, oh man, I'm doing something right here. The Professor of the Year thing, not to take anything away from that, that was amazing, but it doesn't change the fact that, you know, I'm here to try and be an influence on these students and to help them to realize their potential.
Helping students realize their potential seems to be going well for Horzempa, as Mackenzie Jacobs, the student you heard from earlier, has just been given 2 grants through West Virginia NASA to research over the summer.
I am the peptidoglycan.
That was Corey Nollinger reporting from just outside Wheeling, West Virginia. We learned in elementary science class about the Earth's layers and plate tectonics, right? So it makes sense that some efforts to modernize civilization across the country, like underground water lines, can be disrupted or damaged simply by, well, getting old. And in some places here in the Appalachians, the combination of steep mountains, low valleys, and heavy rainfall creates flash flooding that can ravage communities. WKYU's Becca Schimmel takes a look at how flooding affects homes and the water we rely on.
The screen door of a now vacant house swings open on a windy but sunny day on Windcrest Drive in Davis County. The large front window of a place one couple called home for 50 years is gone. Inside sits a single chair and some forgotten decorations on the wall. This house is in the middle of an area prone to repetitive flooding. Davis County Emergency Management Director Andy Ball has another name for it.
This is what we like to refer to, us and the county engineer, as the cereal bowl of the neighborhood. This is where all water, once it starts slowing down and backs up, this is where it all kind of flows out of the creek. This is the worst area down here.
Many of the homes on Windcrest Drive have been inundated with water for years because of heavy rain. Ball secured a Federal Emergency Management Agency mitigation grant for the area. The homes included in the project will be leveled, and FEMA guidelines say no structures can ever be built on that land again. Federal funding made the Windcrest Drive project possible, but the funding path for Kentucky's drinking and wastewater systems is less clear. In 2018, the American Water Infrastructure Act became law. One section of the law authorized $4.4 billion in grants for the nation's drinking water needs. Those grants are given out over the course of 3 years, but according to the American Society of Civil Engineers report card, Kentucky alone needs $15 billion of investment for its aging drinking and wastewater systems. However, age isn't the only thing having an effect on water infrastructure. Extreme weather events are also taking a toll.
Heavy rain events in eastern Kentucky can lead to flash flooding and very short-term flooding. But as you head down toward the central part of the state, and even especially the western end of the state, flooding can linger for very long periods of time.
That's Mary Lamb, the surface hydrologist for the National Weather Forecast Office in Paducah. She says Kentucky is a water-rich state, and we have to be responsible with that resource.
Water means everything to this state. It's a matter of managing what we've got and what we can expect. And there are things that are out of control, but there are things that, you know, we can mediate.
Carrie Johnson agrees with that sentiment. The assistant director for the Kentucky Division of Water says the increase in heavier rain events is putting stress on Kentucky's water infrastructure.
The biggest disaster that you may have from a flooding event may not be from the actual flood itself, but from the impacts to the infrastructure after the flood water recedes.
Johnson says the state's wastewater systems can contribute contaminants to the water when it floods. He says that's especially a risk for septic systems because they aren't managed in the same central way that a sewer system is. Johnson adds that while the vast majority of Kentuckians are connected to systems that deliver reliable drinking water, it's a different picture for wastewater. Many Kentuckians rely on aging septic systems that are costly to repair or replace.
So we're really at the precipice of a dire need to start addressing not only the drinking, but also the wastewater systems that we do have throughout the Commonwealth and the nation because they are aging out.
Johnson says there isn't a water system in the state that doesn't have some kind of need for improvement.
And it certainly is a piece of infrastructure. Septic systems are infrastructure. And I don't know that, you know, that's been communicated very clearly to folks over the years.
I'm Becca Schimmel in Bowling Green.
That story originally aired in May 2019. While most Kentuckians have access to clean water, the infrastructure that makes that possible is aging and in dire need of repair. And as infrastructure continues to age and weather patterns continue to change, the problems may only get worse. These water problems, both drinking water and wastewater, are expected to plague the state and the nation for years to come. On today's show, we're talking about how people are shaped by their surroundings. Building roads, maintaining bridges, and establishing good city water systems to both provide clean water and remove wastewater are difficult and expensive. The very nature of the mountains we love makes it difficult to maintain infrastructure such as water systems. Hillsides slip. Water seeps in and then freezes and causes the ground to rise and buckle. Water lines don't break when it's convenient or easy to fix either. They break when it's below freezing outside or heavy rains cause the ground to shift. Living without access to consistent clean tap water can be anything from an inconvenience to expensive to even a health hazard. And if there's no water operator around, communities will eventually suffer. Right now, there aren't enough trained water operators in parts of Appalachia. And in this next story, Becca Schimmel reports some operators are even coming out of retirement to train people in other districts.
If you don't know exactly where the Tompkinsville water plant is, you probably won't be able to find it. I drive past a high school, over a bridge, and take a left into a narrow driveway. Down the hill, a small gray building comes into view. Walking up the road is Jonathan Shaw, the supervisor of this small water plant. He says he's proud to be the one responsible for delivering clean, potable water to the people of Tompkinsville.
I tell people all the time, I said, I'm the water boy.
Shaw is 39 years old and says he's one of the youngest individuals at the required water plant operator certification classes.
You're looking at people are getting ready to retire and there's going to be a need for operators. And where's it going to come from?
Kentucky has 430 water treatment plants, and most of the people in charge of these water systems are nearing retirement. There aren't many people in line ready to take over for them. It can be difficult to get people interested in a field that can't pay much because salaries are dependent on water rates set by small municipalities with limited budgets. David Goodrum worked at the Glasgow water plant for 35 years. About a year into retirement, he got a call from the state asking if he would consider coming out of retirement to help Tompkinsville's water district, 30 miles south of Glasgow.
The city had gotten problems, got in trouble, and they were looking to solve problems. And somebody in Frankfort gave her my name to call, and she called me and said, would you be willing to talk to the mayor?
Goodrum says the expense of aging infrastructure makes it difficult for small districts like Tompkinsville to comply with state and federal regulations. Goodrum says help should come from the branch of government passing costly mandates.
I'm going to say that's fine, but you're going to have to give funding so those small systems can redo their infrastructure and upgrade their treatment plants to newer technology to meet those new standards.
Goodrum says Tompkinsville has had additional challenges finding funding. He says the Tompkinsville plant used to serve all of Monroe County until the county built its own water plant. Goodrum says the Tompkinsville plant lost about two-thirds of its budget as a result, and it's been hard to get local support for more funding.
It really bugs me because cell phones are in every hand of just about every individual. And I guarantee you your cell phone bill is three times higher than your water bill. But you raise your water rates by $1 a month, and people throw a fit.
Goodrum says another problem is that people don't understand where their water comes from or how important it is to have it treated.
I've had people say, well, I can go down here in the creek. I said, well, go right ahead. I said, enjoy your time because you're going to not leave that house for a few days. Because especially here in South Central Kentucky where the karst topography, I've tested wells, I've tested springs, I've tested any type of water coming out of the ground you can test in this part of the state, and I've never tested one without E. coli in it. Never.
Staffing water treatment plants and locating funding for improvements is a problem across the state. The Labor Cabinet has been trying to work with Big Sandy Community and Technical College to create and recruit people for a water plant operator apprenticeship. So far, the program is only in the discussion stage. I'm Becca Schimmel in Bowling Green.
You can find more information about water operator training programs in Kentucky and West Virginia on our website. That's wvpublic.org/InsideAppalachia. On Inside Appalachia, we don't shy away from investigating the tougher realities people are facing, but we also like to shine a light on the work being done to solve the problems and the ways we make it happen. I'll admit, sometimes I look around and I see trash. Heaps of trash. Sometimes scattered in rows of litter or maybe bagged and tossed carelessly along a back road. Trash is a growing global problem, too. Humans are producing waste at a rapid pace, and most of our trash ends up in landfills. In the United States, we produce more than 200 million tons of trash every single year. But some communities in Appalachia are turning garbage into fuel. Liz McCormick takes us to West Virginia's Eastern Panhandle to find out more.
This is it.
That's what it looks like.
And isn't it safe to touch, too?
Yeah, it's all stabilized.
Confetti or something?
Emily Dyson opens a gallon-sized Ziploc bag full of soft, confetti-like material. It has no smell, and it looks kind of like colorful shredded fabric. This stuff was garbage, and now it's been broken down, cleaned, and can be used as a fuel source. Dyson is a scientist, and she directs the research and operations here at Ensorga, West Virginia, a new waste-to-energy facility located in Martinsburg. There are similar efforts to turn trash into energy elsewhere in the United States, but this one is the first in the country to use a unique technology called HBIOT, or high-efficiency biological treatment. It speeds up the process, turning trash to fuel in less than 3 weeks. Ensorga is based in Italy. Its technology senses and separates garbage to collect biomass, plastics, and other carbon-based materials. Then, through the use of large fans and mulch, yes, mulch, the garbage is cleaned, composted, then separated and shredded, and can then be used as fuel. Dyson says this sort of technology will solve a lot of waste and fuel problems, but is only one piece of the puzzle.
From a waste perspective, there's not going to be one technology that's going to solve the waste problems of the U.S. From a fuel perspective, there's not going to be one fuel, one power source that's going to fix the energy issues that we face here. But you might as well be using waste because that's a definite recyclable commodity. Everybody makes waste.
Dyson says nearly 80% of garbage that comes to Ensorga will be diverted from a landfill, and at least half of that will be turned into fuel. Fuel that will be used at a local cement factory in Berkeley County. Ensorga's fuel will also replace a portion of coal used there.
It burns cleaner than coal. The cement plant will use up to 30% offset or supplement of their coal.
Insorga, West Virginia opened its doors this spring, and it's having a considerable effect on lessening the amount of garbage going into a landfill. Clint Hogben, chairman of the Berkeley County Solid Waste Authority and who invited Insorga to locate to West Virginia, says in its first full month of operation, the facility saw more than 1,000 tons of waste that either became fuel or was recycled at the Berkeley County Solid Waste Authority.
That's an immediate 10% landfill reduction in their first month for the entire Eastern Panhandle. If you add all the waste stream of the three county Eastern Panhandle, that's in their first month, it's immediate 10% landfill reduction.
But let's back up. How does garbage become the fluffy stuff we saw in that Ziploc bag? Well, here's how it works.
So basically, I'll give you the overview here. Trucks come in, they scale in. Everything about this plant is automated.
Residents in Berkeley, Jefferson, and Morgan counties take their garbage out to the curb once a week, like anywhere else. But only Apple Valley Waste customers see their trash sent to Insorga. Their trash is picked up and brought to the Berkeley County Solid Waste Authority along Grapevine Road in Martinsburg. The Insorga facility sits just behind the Solid Waste Authority on 12 acres of land. The garbage trucks are weighed, and then the contents are emptied into the Insorga building. After the trash is dropped off, Insorga's Hibiot technology begins its work. There's no human intervention in the Insorga process, just the employees who operate the machines and watch the monitors.
So this is the control room. Hi, guys. Material is picked up with that big crane right there.
A large screen shows multiple camera views of the machines at work, spinning, cleaning, or shredding the garbage. Dyson says the waste will sit in what's called the biooxidation hall for a couple weeks, while a large fan system sucks and blows air through the ventilation system.
And that is what accelerates that composting, because we're drying that material out fast. What normally takes 3 to 9 months, we're doing in that 10 to 14, 16 days.
Mulch plays a big part of the ventilation process by absorbing and breaking down the garbage smells. It helps to clean and compost the trash that'll eventually become fuel. But getting Insorga to locate to West Virginia has not been without its struggles. It took 10 years to get all the permits cleared, in part because the facility was a brand new thing for the state, and there was also some pushback from community members.
The first public hearing, there was a lot of people, there was a lot of questions.
She says most of the concerns came from a lack of understanding about how the technology works.
It's hard to wrap your head around that unless you see it.
There was also some opposition by landfill companies. Again, here's Clint Hogben with the Berkeley County Solid Waste Authority.
If you're a landfill, if you're a facility that's going to lose a lot of intake because of this facility, you might be upset and you might get involved and slow it down. So we had some of that.
Hogben says the Eastern Panhandle needed a waste-to-energy facility simply because of the rate at which the area is growing, to find an alternative to landfilling. And he says he hopes Insorga, West Virginia, will be an example for the rest of the country.
I'm hoping those solid waste decision makers will come to Martinsburg, visit the facility, and I'm hoping in that way the ripple effect would be that, that West Virginia changed the direction of management of solid waste. It might be nice to be first at something.
Insorga, West Virginia's fuel product is being utilized by one local cement plant in Martinsburg. But both Hogben and Dyson say there are other cement companies who may contract with them in the future. And there's the possibility that other companies may have an interest in the product, too. For Inside Appalachia, I'm Liz McCormick in Martinsburg, West Virginia.
Earlier in the show, we heard a writer talking about discovering his roots. The last story in our show this week could be told from many places across the world. It's the joyous, sincere feeling of waking up as a kid to a snow day. Those of us who live in higher elevations of the mountains or a bit further away from the equator probably know exactly what they're talking about. The writer is Eden DeHart. She uses her story to explore her surroundings and understand her world better. Here's Eden DeHart reading her story, Write Like Your Life Depends on It.
Hi, I'm Eden DeHart, a third grader from Rochester, Michigan. I won first place in the West Virginia Public Broadcasting's writing contest with my story titled, Write Like Your Life Depends on It. I love to read and write, across all types of genres. In fact, my dream is to one day become a New York Times best-selling author. Throughout the year, my teacher, Miss Hicks, has been giving me a variety of independent writing challenges. She identified this contest and thought it would be a great opportunity for me to try my hand at something new, writing and illustrating my first children's book. I wrote this story this past winter break. It was a particularly snowy, cold winter in Michigan. I took inspirations from my surroundings to develop the setting and plot for my story. And just as you'll hear me read shortly, my ideas came faster than my hand could write. My story is about a girl who wakes up on a snow day and uses her imagination to create a story that ultimately turns into a New York Times best-selling novel. What I remember most about writing this story was that as the words came to me, I actually heard them in my mind set to music, as though I were writing lyrics to a song. Now, I'm excited to share my story with you. Write Like Your Life Depends on It, written and illustrated by Eden DeHart. The buzz of my alarm clock startled me awake from a deep sleep. I sat up, sleepy-eyed and yawning. I moaned, "Another day of school. But it's so early. But wait, it was so bright in my room." I looked outside and saw it. So much luscious and velvety snow, blanketing the grass, reflecting light through my window. "Whoa," I said, as I heard my mom's footsteps climbing up the stairs. And then it happened. The five most glorious words a kid could hear came spilling out of mom's mouth. "Honey, it's a snow day," she whispered, trying not to disturb me. "You can go back to sleep." Yet my formerly sleepy eyes widened bigger than donuts, and my yawns turned into squeals of delight. Now, most kids would throw on their snow gear and dash outside in an attempt to make the world's largest snowman. Not me. A blank sheet of paper was calling my name. Where will my adventures take me? Maybe down to the deep blue sea. My imagination is the key. The world awaits something great, the next bestseller, best to date. I can go as far as I can dream. Inspiration is all around me. Words are flowing out my brain. My ideas come faster than my hand can write. I have so much in my heart to share, but now I'm thinking, do I dare? These special thoughts are mine, not theirs. But I cannot contain myself. I have so many stories I wish to tell. All I need is to be brave. A pencil and paper unlocks the door. Across the world, I can soar. I can climb mountains and face down a lion's roar. I can do anything as long as I can dream. So here I go. I'm on my way, on the writing trail to a brighter day, discovering the author inside of me. Words turn into paragraphs. Paragraphs turn into pages. Pages turn into chapters, and chapters turn into the next bestseller. By Eden DeHart. What a sensational snow day!
Again, that was Eden DeHart reading her story, Write Like Your Life Depends on It. The story won first place in the third grade division of West Virginia Public Broadcasting's 2019 Writers' Contest. Eden is from Michigan, but the contest is open to young writers from all over the country. Good work, Eden, and thanks for recording your story for us. You can see the rest of this year's writing contest winners at wvpublic.org/education. You can also find out how to enter next year's contest. What does it mean to be Appalachian? Is it time spent within the geographical borders of the Appalachian region designated by the federal government? If so, how long do you have to live here to call yourself Appalachian? Is it a cultural identity shared across state lines or even oceans? Some say being Appalachian means being poor and ignorant. You know what? There are lots of people with little money in my neighborhood. And there's a lot of this world that we haven't seen. And their lives are still worthy of human decency, respect, and civil rights. Like I said earlier in the show, I didn't know I was Appalachian until, well, I started working on the show. I was born and raised in southern West Virginia, the only state 100% within the geographical borders of Appalachia. The more I realized that people turned up their nose at me not only because I was West Virginian, but also because I was Appalachian, well, it made me want to share the strengths of our struggles and beauty in our pain even more. I refuse to be ashamed of who I am and where I come from just because some journalist or researcher may think their life is more valuable than mine. You shouldn't be either. Perhaps it's the fierce, independent spirit that I just can't hide. Hey, before I let you go, I wanted to see if you could help us with something we're working on. We're planning an episode of Inside Appalachia about love and Appalachia.
Send us an audio clip of your thoughts about love or love-hate relationship with Appalachia. Remember to identify yourself and tell us where you live. Keep it to a maximum of 2 minutes. If you need to write down your thoughts before you record it, try to tell your story naturally without looking down at what you wrote as much as possible. Use the voice memo feature on your smartphone and email your love letters to Appalachia to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org. The deadline is January 31st. Until next week, thanks for joining me as we journey throughout Appalachia. We had help producing Inside Appalachia this week from WKYU in Bowling Green, Kentucky, WOSU in Columbus, Ohio, and the West Virginia Public Broadcasting Education Department. Music in today's show was provided by Dinosaur Burbs, Marisa Anderson, Michael Howard, and Ben Townsend. Roxy Todd is our producer. Eric Douglas is our associate producer. Our executive producer is Jesse Wright. He also edited our show this week. Our audio mixer is Patrick Stevens. You can find us online on Twitter at InAppalachia. You can also send us an email to insideappalachia@wvpublic.org or visit wvpublic.org to sign up for our new Inside Appalachia newsletter. On our website, you can also subscribe or download all of our stories or look for the Inside Appalachia podcast wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Jessica Lilly. Inside Appalachia is a production of West Virginia Public Broadcasting.